What you're about to hear is of a general advice nature. It does not take into account your personal needs and financial objectives. We recommend you seek financial advice before making any decisions about your super and consider the relevant Plum product disclosure statement. Full details of our services and remuneration are in our financial services guide, which is available to anyone listening at the bottom of the podcast and tutorials webpage on the Plum website. Hello and welcome to the Plum Super Podcast Series. My name is Chris Hodges. I'm here today with my colleague Marcus Thompson, two of your superannuation consultants at MLC Wealth. Our role is to provide information, guidance and advice to our super members throughout their working life and into retirement. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here.
And today we're here to talk about the benefits of seeking personal financial advice, with this conversation being part two of a two-part series. And to assist us with this topic, I'm pleased to say we're joined again by a guest. Welcome back, Liam Diggan, who is a financial planner with Mentor One Financial Advice. Thanks for joining us again to complete this topic.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be part of this.
And for clarity, Liam is licensed through Consultant Financial Advisors, one of the licensees under MLC Wealth. Just to recap, this topic is all about the benefits of receiving personal financial advice and has been prepared for people listening who may never previously have met with a financial planner and for those who may have had a relationship previously with a financial planner, but that is no longer in place. In the first podcast conversation, we provided an introduction to the financial planning industry and explored the financial planning experience from the point of view of a client, including the various meetings involved and information exchange leading up to the various strategies that may be relevant and the provision of formal advice.
And part two today.
In part two of this podcast series today, we'll go into a bit more detail about the types of advice that can be provided, what is contained in a statement of advice, and some information around the costs of obtaining financial advice. Liam is also going to take us through a real client scenario of his and how they've benefited from financial advice and to try to bring to life the advice proposition, which I think will be very helpful. Again, quite a few points to cover as part of this topic, with the ultimate objective remaining the same, that is for people listening to better understand the role of a financial planner, the reasons for getting advice, and how it might help them.
Liam, at the end of part one, we concluded with you saying the first meeting with the prospective client is about getting to know each other and finding out where you can add value. We know that any formal recommendations ultimately need to be presented in the form of a written document, a statement of advice. Naturally, this advice document will be different for all clients, but really, what is encompassed in a statement of advice and does it follow a set style and include particular content?
Yes, Marcus, the SOA can be a hefty document, so much for the paperless office. Seriously though, it is important and it is set out in a way that we think is easy to navigate. So this is what our typical SOA looks like. We start off with an executive summary, which sometimes can be well demonstrated using diagrams. Then we cover off what the advice is for, or in financial speak, the scope, what the client's agreed goals and objectives are, their current situation, their tolerance to risk, and then we get into the nitty-gritty of it all. The recommendations are presented in detail, showing strategies and products, and we even show some alternative comparison recommendations and products too. That part helps show people the reasons why we think using our recommendations will put the client in a better position, and that's important to be able to demonstrate. Our retirement recommendations always show in-depth projections and modelling so people can see how much money they'll have left at any point in time and how long we expect it to last. Costs and fees are the next section, followed by an authority, which a client signs and should they wish to have the advice implemented.
And easy to read with no jargon. I mention this because we know people have different levels of financial literacy and may be daunted by a large document.
Chris, yes, it can be a substantial document depending on their situation, but it is set out using plain language that we think is easy to understand. And of course, if there are areas that need further explanation, we can assist with that before any of the recommendations are accepted and implemented. That's all part of our role.
And Liam, what are the various items that are typically included in the advice you provide?
For people about to retire, we'll look at their super fund, review the portfolio and investments. We look at fees and where we can do better, if it's appropriate, additional contributions, and then what sort of retirement income they think they might need. We'll look at Centrelink eligibility and the structure of assets, and we can assist with applying for Centrelink benefits. Other items like budgets and wills or estate planning are generally applicable to pretty much everyone too.
And I'm guessing there must be some cases where your clients feel like they have some of these things already under control and don't need your involvement.
Yes, Chris, that's correct. The client may ask us not to provide advice on certain areas of their situation, and that's fine. We call that limiting the scope of the plan, and any such agreements, of course, are specifically documented in the SOA. Right at the start, we make it clear we are providing advice on and we're specifically excluding any areas and the reasons why.
And speaking about fees, we know the cost of obtaining financial advice has been topical in recent times, but what can you tell us about the approximate costs involved and more broadly, the structure of how you charge for your services?
Yes, Marcus, a very important point. There's many different models for charging fees within the industry. In our practice, we charge a fee to produce the statement of advice. This can be a large piece of work and often incorporates a lot of research and projections to determine the appropriate strategies to recommend. Sometimes that might include things like family trusts or complex structures. We include our implementation cost in that initial advice fee.
And what about ongoing advice?
We also identify if there's a need for a level of ongoing advice where we know there'll be a need to adjust the plan based on certain events occurring. On the other hand, sometimes the advice can be set and forget. And by that, I mean it might be structured in such a way as to set someone up on the right path for quite a few years, and we might not really need to touch base again for a while. Or it could be advice that is quite simple and transactional. But as we've already alluded, every plan is different, and for that reason, it is difficult to give an approximate cost. All our fees are flat dollar, that is not percentage-based, and before we provide the advice, we always demonstrate the value for the client.
Just to your point there, Liam, can you give us an example of how you may demonstrate the value for the client at this point of the process? Do you have a simple example for this that you can share?
Absolutely, Chris. One of my rules is if you can't add value to a person's situation, I'll tell them. And to be perfectly honest, it doesn't happen very often. There have been many scenarios over the year where the fees my clients pay me have been far outweighed in dollar figures anyway by savings they've been able to gain. This might be in reducing fees charged by the investment fund itself by pressing a few buttons or structuring assets to enable the client to maximise Centrelink benefits or even setting up things to save on tax. Just as important, though, I really believe the true value of a planner's advice can be found when you've got clients who understand their plan and it does what it's meant to do, putting people in the best possible position where the real value lies, and that includes giving them peace of mind.
Liam, with respect to your earlier point about scoped advice, can that have an impact on the fees charged for advice?
Absolutely, Marcus, it can. Fees can be charged based on holistic advice covering the client's full situation, or scaled for a more limited scope agreement. A good example of limited scope advice would be investing someone super in line with their risk profile, where before it may have been in a default fund or cash, or other assets completely out of line with what's appropriate for that person.
And Liam, just on a related point, many people, of course, have existing investments before partnering with a financial planner, maybe some Telstra shares from the various floats or some managed funds. How is this situation normally treated? Do you provide advice on these two, or are they simply wrapped up in the client's overall portfolio?
Chris, it really depends on how the client wants us to deal with that. Some people prefer to keep that separate. Other people like to package everything together. In contrast, sometimes it's also a good time for a spring clean of all the old socks in the drawer, so to speak. If someone isn't sure which way to go, we can run through the pros and cons of each scenario too.
Now, Liam, just back to the start of this conversation, I mentioned I would ask you about a real client scenario of yours to better illustrate the nature of financial advice and the benefits that can be achieved. Can you paint the picture for us of such a case, please, without using real names, of course? Maybe you can start with the various meetings that took place and what happened at each one before a plan was put into place.
Chris, I have so many stories to tell, but let me tell you about a client. Let's call her Mary. Mary came to me seeking advice about her employer's super fund. She'd been accumulating money in her super for over 20 years and had a balance to show for it too. During our first meeting, she told me she was thinking about retirement. The mortgage was paid off and the kids had all moved out a while ago. She wasn't sure how to turn the super savings into a pension income stream. So the natural process of discovery for us is to drill down a bit into the super fund and find out where the money's invested, and look at the fees and insurance and anything else that might be eating into it. Mary's fund had a fair bit of insurance attached, and the premiums were pretty high compared to other providers. The way her super was invested attracted high fees too. Not only that, we discovered she had a few other super accounts from previous jobs too, but wasn't sure who, with, or how to round them all up.
So where did you start?
What we did for Mary, Chris, was look at her need for the insurance first. We like to conduct a risk needs analysis for our clients, and that helps us determine what levels and type of insurance, if any, will best suit their needs and budget. Since she had no dependents or mortgage, we decided there was no need for it. Instant saving, I think it was about $4,500 a year that was coming directly out of her super savings. Next, we had a look at her risk profile and can see that her money was invested in some obscure and expensive funds that really didn't align with where she should have been.
Just on that point, Liam, can you briefly explain risk profile and how you go about determining this?
Sure, Marcus. Risk profiling follows a philosophy around the risk versus return scale. Many of your listeners would have come across that or something like it before. The higher the risk you take, the higher potential return. And conversely, the lower the risk, the lower the return. So, for example, if you leave your money in the bank or say in a cash fund within your super account, the return on those funds is currently below 1%, which is low return, but the risk of losing on that investment is extremely low, in theory. On the other end of the scale, the potential return on your money that's invested in shares could be very high. We've all got that one mate that loves telling anyone to listen about how he tripled his money overnight by putting it all in one share. It does happen, but it's extremely risky, as we all know. When there are certain world events like pandemic we're living through now, the share markets can be up and down by a huge amount in one day.
So how do you work out a person's risk profile?
So the way we work out a person's risk profile, Marcus, or tolerance to risk, is by asking a series of questions to which they pick the answer that best suits their attitude. Some of those questions are about the time frame a client expects for the investment of their funds, short, medium, or long term. Other questions will focus around a person's appetite and capacity for risk, or the risk of their investment losing money or not generating enough income to meet their living expenses. Each answer has a point value, and when you add them up, you get a score. Your score will fall into one of six or seven ranges, starting from very low risk tolerance or very conservative, all the way to very high risk tolerance or appetite.
Thanks, Liam. And back to Mary's story.
Yes, Chris, in Mary's case, by switching her investments to line the asset allocation up with her tolerance to risk, we were able to move her retirement savings into areas that suited her much better, especially given she was close to retirement. That alone reduced the admin and management fees in the fund by around $7,500 a year. We rounded up all the other accounts she had, so all the money was in one place. After that work was done, she had some good in-depth discussions about her retirement plans and how she thought that would look. We decided on a retirement date that would coincide with age pension age, which was only 12 months down the track. We determined she'd be at an advantage to make a personal contribution as well and keep some cash in the bank.
And from there?
Marcus, next month I'm due to meet with Mary again and we'll bed down a pension strategy, which will include a review of her risk profile and things like how much income she'll need on top of Centrelink. And a final point worth noting, this case study is about a single person, Mary. But sometimes with couples, I find their goals are not aligned, even after they've been together for 30 or 40 years or sometimes longer. For example, I've seen situations where they both express a goal to do lots of travel in retirement, but have never really discussed their destinations. Sometimes it turns out one wants to go to America and the other prefers Europe and has no interest in America. Or one doesn't want to travel overseas at all, preferring to tow a caravan around Australia. So a good idea in my experience for members of a couple that might be listening to this is to be discussing their goals together, particularly leading up to retirement.
Yes, that sounds like a very good point, Liam. And I understand in the case of Mary that the advice was put in place several years ago. I'm also very interested in the ongoing part of the relationship. How often do you typically meet with clients to review their plans? And can you think of events that have necessitated a major change to their plan?
Chris, part of our ongoing service program includes unlimited access to me as the advisor via email, phone calls, or in person. I recently had a couple who've been clients for a few years now sell their investment property, and we were able to guide them on making a lump sum contribution to their super as they're only a couple of years away from retirement. That kind of thing is something that's part of the ongoing service. It's important to note here that the client also has a role to play in the relationship. We need them to be making us aware of any changes that are taking place in their lives and with their financial circumstances. It's only then that we can make any adjustments to the plan and make sure it stays on track to meet their ultimate goals. So the annual review doesn't necessarily need to be timed for a set part of the year. We also want to hear from clients with details of any major changes that might need to be considered.
Liam, thanks for joining us today to discuss the benefits of seeking personal financial advice. It feels like we've covered a lot across our two conversations as part of this podcast topic. As part of our roles as super consultants, Marcus and I work with corporate super members of MLC Wealth. We're big supporters of the value of financial advice, and it forms a part of every interaction that we have with our members. And as part of that, we frequently arrange introductions for our members with a licensed financial planner and have also seen the benefits that it can have. So Marcus, if people are interested in meeting with a financial planner to discuss their situation, how can they go about it? And as we've done in other podcasts, where can they go for further information about any other aspect of their Plum superannuation account?
Thanks, Chris. Yes, there's a few sources of support for our members. The first one's a Plum website, and that's www.plum.com.au. Lots of useful information here. Remind people that it's a great idea to set themselves up with online access to their account, if they haven't already done so. You can also check out our range of podcast topics here via our Financial Wellness Hub, which can be accessed from the News and Views tab on the website. On the Financial Wellness Hub, you'll also find educational and interactive content that goes beyond superannuation, addressing your holistic needs by providing access to industry experts and thought leaders. There's also the Plum Contact Centre, and they can be contacted on 1300 55 7586 between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, Monday to Friday. If you would like additional information on a more personal basis, there's a couple of options. Firstly, there's a one-on-one conversation with one of our Plum representatives, such as Chris and myself, and these are done on a general advice basis. They can be booked for a convenient time also by the Financial Wellness Hub. Or, for personal financial advice, like we've discussed with Liam today, you can set up an initial complimentary meeting with one of our licensed financial planners. This can be initiated through the Plum Contact Centre on 1300 55 7586.
Liam, thanks again for assisting us with this podcast. I'm sure the information has been helpful and has provided some clarity around the role of a financial planner and the benefits of seeking personal financial advice. And Marcus, for your role too in jointly hosting with me today. A reminder that the content today is general information. Thanks and bye for now.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye from me too.